Pushkin. In the 1970s, Jackson Browne was known as one of the originators of the carefree California classic rock sound, with hits like Doctor My Eyes and Running on Empty. As his career progressed, Jackson Browne's knack for writing soul-searching lyrics turned more political. He began to write protest songs that addressed weighty issues like environmental degradation and U.S. foreign policy. Browne continues to use his music as a vehicle for change today. His latest album, Downhill From Everywhere, was inspired by a documentary about the Pacific Garbage Patch and our impact on the planet. On today's episode, Bruce Headlam talks to Jackson Browne about how he is able to turn catastrophic headlines into palatable songs. Browne also talks about moving to New York City when he was 18 and writing songs for the Velvet Underground's Nico. Browne also remembers the time his former label boss, David Geffen, shut down his attempt to quote the Black Panther's Bobby Seale in a song.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Bruce Headlam and Jackson Browne.
I want to talk about your new album, of course. First of all, where did the title come from?
It comes from an oceanographer named Captain Charles Moore, the guy that discovered the North Pacific Gyre, all the plastic swirling in the gyre has become known as the Pacific Garbage Patch. But he's the guy that sort of discovered it and sort of brought it to attention of the rest of the world. And in talking about the ocean and in our impact on the ocean, he says that the ocean is downhill from everywhere. And that's where the title comes from. And it's really at the heart of what the song is talking about, you know, humans' impact on the planet.
You know, this album, it has political songs like that one, The Dreamer. It's got other songs that deal with current issues. And this surprised me. It seemed like a very optimistic album to me. The personal songs seem very optimistic, which is not always something I associate with your music. It wasn't wistful or valedictory. Were you in a good mood when you wrote this album? Were you in a good place?
This album got written over a period of years. So I think that that maybe I have a desire to be optimistic or to be hopeful, not optimistic, but to be hopeful. The act of writing a song, I think I reflexively want to leave things in a there to be some light, some possibility for a positive outcome.
You know, in Still Looking for Something, Looking for Love, you're, you know, Minutes from Downtown, they're the songs of somebody who's kind of in the game and enjoying it.
The whole album has a sense of dealing with things that are interminable, things that are going on and on and on, problems that were there before and are there now. Yet it's about moving forward, and it's about trying to find your way, you know, forward. As far as being in the game, you know, you got to think that you are, even if you're not.
Come on, you must be in the game, please. Give us hope here.
To want to make music, you know, you have to have, that's the thing, just that you want to, you know, that you still want to. I mean, it'd be easy to get tired of it. But I think that probably the reason I don't is I don't do it all the time. I'm not releasing album after album and, you know, releasing an album every year or two. You know, it's just, I mean, the song, The Dreamer, I've been trying to write that many years ago, and it just sort of took a turn. I met this guy, Eugene Rodriguez, and showed him this old song idea I had, which began with, you know, like the Minutemen being down on the border, enforcing, you know, trying to, you know, vigilantism. And it just turned into a song about a young person coming to this country and giving her future to this country, and that is so optimistic. There's so much hope in that. In the midst of the debacle that is our immigration policy and the years of trying to deny, you know, access to people who were fundamentally here before we were, and you know, to a great extent, you know, people have been coming from Mexico to California or Arizona, you know, since before they were in the union. It's just like they're the best among us. Immigrants. My grandmother came here when she was 16. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot about this country that the optimism that people have when they come here. folded together with the difficulties they endure. But, you know, it's a mixture of both, you know, hardship, optimism, you know, struggle in all of these songs, I think.
You mentioned The Dreamer, and I'm wondering when you do write a song that way, you know, because your personal songs, people relate to them because of sort of commonality of emotions that people have and the dilemmas they face in life. When you're approaching a more political song, do you say, I want to write something about immigration because it's wrong? I mean, how do you get from there? How do you get from the sort of high level New York Times headline to the emotional heart of a song like that?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the thing that I've tried to do in the past sometimes to try to broach a subject strategically and try to draw people into the subject and talk about what matters to each of us. And here's the problem with anything political is if you're too oblique, they won't know what you're talking about. And if you're too direct, you run the risk of making people feel that they're being sort of scolded or lectured. Honestly, I told myself, look, I want this to sound like the way it would sound like if you and I were drinking in a bar and we're just talking about what's going on in the world, not that as if you have some sort of elevated place and lecturing people about something they should know about but don't or that they should care. You know, you have to make people, you have to get to people where they do care and where what they do know about. Mm-hmm. In the case of Downhill from Everywhere, it's not exactly political because there's no polemic. There is just like a bunch of compounding and sort of contrasting images. You know, the prison, the mall, factory farming, the hospital. And the fun of it was to make it flow out of it so that these seem like stream of consciousness. And sometimes it was, but you have to make those words sound good with rock and roll. And what I really wanted was a song that you didn't have to listen to the words to at all. You would just listen. You might hear some of them going by while you're listening to the guitar part or the drum, bass and the drums. And I just wanted to feel good. Mm-hmm. I decided not to talk. I mean, I had like a verse that was going to, you know, it wasn't going like to name Trump. I just didn't want a song with his name in it. I wasn't going to refer to him, but I was going to be talking about like, you know, downhill from the White House, downhill from the dump, downhill from that something, or the downhill from the biopsy and that suspicious lump. And yeah, right. But that's the editor in me that said, okay, maybe you can put that aside. We'll keep looking.
Do you think as a result of this last year, when you go back out on the road, are there songs of yours from your catalog you say, you know, suddenly this makes sense now if I take this out in a way it might not have 2 years ago?
I'm not sure. The process of deciding what you're going to play is a really involved thing. I'd say I'm more involved in with which of my old songs the audience wants to hear after having been shut down for this amount of time, and which of my new songs I can, you know, I can expect to get a real strong listening to. You know, there were times when I went out and tried to play every new song in an album in a set, and you wind up playing, you know, more than half the songs would be these new songs, and I got sort of chided by some of my friends, like, and people really come to hear you what they already know, and you might want to just like cut that down to two or three songs. And at the same time, I think that this is a really important time where people do want to know what's transpired. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these songs were, you know, written before and the pandemic, and they're about the last several years, or they're the culmination. Some of the songs go back a lot longer than that. And matter of fact, Downhill from Everywhere was the song I was writing for a long time. And what I think is probably not going to be apparent to anybody, you know, but how would anybody know? But I mean, I've got on my laptop screen here, I've got like all these sound checks where I'm trying to play that song. I play these things back, and there are moments when like I thought, okay, that's the way the drums have to play this song. Well, that's, or the time that Greg Lee's played this incredible, like, dang it, dang, dang it, dang it, this really great guitar lick. He figured it out. All these sound checks where something happened, and I go, oh, yeah. And then there was a time where I cut the song, and I say, look, I'm screwing this up. Let me just try to play my guitar part. Jeff, you sing it. And he's singing, so my keyboard is the guy that's singing this line, downhill from the border. Well, he's swinging it in a certain way. He just hears things that way. He goes like, dun, 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 dun. So he's swinging the track that way with his la, la, la's, whatever he's mm-hmm. singing to lead the band. Whereas the melody really goes da, 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 all that, da, 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 and it's against the beat, which provides a kind of tension, and you can get away with it, but it's not as, in the end, I tried to convert all the phrasing to his phrasing, and that really didn't work. Throwing off the words again, and then coming back to my, I got to go back to my, but then I just realized, I said, just, I can have him answer it. I can have him reaffirm that rhythm with his vocal, you know, downhill from the fat, from the baby's room, downhill from the, you know, so I gave him, I wrote a bunch of lines for him to sing too.
No.
And downhill, I thought, as cool as like getting my singers to sing downhill from the Anthropocene. I was going to have one of them say, look it up. Downhill. You know, it's fun because I'm writing for a band. Like I culled in writing that song. I really culled a guitar part from Greg, a vocal phrasing from Jeff. I mean, a moment where Fritz was kind of channeling the Stones and trying to play this thing. Just make the song about music first, you know.
And so do most songs for you start with lyrical ideas?
It's usually some piece of lyric and music at the same time, a feel or a little bit of music, yeah, at the same time. But it's usually a phrase, yeah.
And but you're still you're a slow writer, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. You noticed.
Yeah. What's the fastest you've ever written a song?
One of the fast songs was on this album, A Little Soon to Say, came up pretty quickly.
What's a little quickly for you?
That I had this idea. And a month later, I really started to write it. And then in a matter of about a week or so, I had kind of, you know.
Wow.
You know, stuff happens. I got a phone call in the middle of writing this verse. And I got a phone from a friend of mine who I work with, like my production guy. And he like, I mean, I've never told him this, too, but in that conversation with him, I just led me into this whole reassessment of my whole, you know, like I didn't find much wisdom when I was. When time was on my side, that old verse came from like a feeling I had from a conversation on the phone while writing the song. It's not like I set out to say something. It's just you. It's a process of uncovering things then in you, you know, within you.
We'll be right back with more from Jackson Brown after this break. We're back with more from Bruce Hedlum and Jackson Brown.
You are associated with Los Angeles in a way that few people are associated with places, you know, maybe Kurt Cobain in Seattle or Willie Nelson in Austin, but you are this Los Angeles character. So I'm interested in that early part of your career when you left, when you went to New York to work. Can you tell me a bit about that? Because it was Dylan who inspired you to a certain extent. And what was it like for, when you're very young, a kid to leave LA and go to New York?
Well, I grew up in L.A. till I was about 13, but then at the time that I went to New York, I'd been living in Orange County. My family had moved out to Fullerton. You know, I kicked myself that I didn't go somehow get a job at the Fender factory and like have like a stash of 60s, you know, Stratocasters that, to show for it. But I was really, yeah, I was really immersed in folk music and Dylan. And continue to be immersed in roots music and folk music after Dylan sort of. See, there's a thing about folk music is that you learn a song and you make it your own. You either combine, maybe you've combined Dave Van Ronk's version of Staggerly with Mississippi John Hurt's version of Staggerly. You take the best of those versions and you put them together and put it in your own. Matter of fact, I wrote a version of Staggerly that in which I combine those versions and I'm quoting Bobby Seale, you know, of the Black Panthers, you know. Like Bobby Seale said, Stagger Lee was the brother off the block whose actions had to speak for him because he couldn't relate to talk. Well, listen, all you millionaires, is something you should know. He gets his shit together. Some of you going to have to go. Is that a political song? The fact is that David Geffen heard that. And he went, huh? Women, what's wrong with millionaires? What's wrong with wanting to be a millionaire? And it didn't make my album. I didn't make the first album. But just so you know, like what I was referring to is that the fact that you made these folk songs speak for you. And it wasn't just like summoning up an arcane song and rendering it faithfully from, you know, it may have started with that. My only Joan Baez, incredible songs that she curated on her albums, you know, but she did something to them. She cast a spell on them that was brand new and traditional and ancient at the same time. So that's what started happening. And Dylan did it, you know, and he did it so well that he sort of, you know, led the whole procession off into like a brand new direction. And I was living in Orange County by the time that started happening, and when I got involved in folk music, before that I listened to my father's music, Dixieland. So some of the great singers, Ella Fitzgerald. And matter of fact, we saw Dylan on the television one time. It was before, first I ever saw him. And it was like a very short show. And it was Dylan sitting on the edge of a stage somewhere. It was maybe one of the first appearances I ever made on TV. And I said, wow, what is this? You know, my dad says, and he wasn't into folk music, but he said, this is the real thing. This is the real thing. He said, I knew guys in the army that sounded like this. He was stationed in Mississippi for a while. He said, this sound reminds me of that guy sitting on the edge of his bed playing the guitar in the barracks. You know, and so he sort of validated Bob Dylan very early on for me at a time when, and then what happened immediately, of course, is that all these songs that he had written were learned by everybody. And the thing is that the job still was to make it your own. So I started writing songs at that, right around that same time. And what you write about what you know,
your dad, what instrument did he play?
He played piano, but he loved horns. He loved the trumpet and he loved the trombone. He played a lot of Jack Teagarden, and he would walk around the house playing the trombone saying, listen, there's only three positions. Can you check out how many notes he's playing? But he's only, now forget having like combinations of keys and fingering. You only have that, that, and that. And then it's your lip. And so he's fascinated with how the trombone is played. He's not good at it, but he actually did one time get to play with Jack Teagarden, and he wound up with Teagarden's tie. And Teagarden like kiped his tie. They left the jam session at 6 a.m. or something, and like Teagarden had his tie, and so he wound up. And it was like a talisman. It was like a prized possession of his. Also a picture of him playing with Django Reinhardt. He was a really good musician. And he wasn't in Reinhardt's band. He actually had booked Reinhardt for these parties and he would get to sit in.
Wow.
So I grew up with that sort of lore. But when folk music happened, it was taking on all this information about the world, about our history and about who really is here, you know? So even though I lived in this like really sterile little tract home in Orange County with my family, I mean, the conduit and the lifeline to the world outside was music.
A lot of musicians I've talked to, their fathers were jazz musicians. Yeah. And often they didn't like their kids' musical choices.
I remember my father coming to see one of my gigs. I vaguely understood that there wasn't a lot about my singing or my songs were not sophisticated. You know, it wasn't like he was not going to get to cross the Jordan, you know, and come go off into the future with us. You know, he was like a, even in jazz, he told me, you know, like he said, like, yeah, Miles Davis, eh.
Wow.
You know, I thought, really? Oh, no. I thought, okay, well, you're definitely telling me where you're at. But we diverged on so many things. He said, you and your friend think you're nonconformist. We didn't really. And they never used that word. There wasn't the issue. He said, but you're going to have to cut your hair and you're going to want to raise a family and then you're going to have to get a job and cut your hair. And I thought, well, I don't think so. You know, so there are all like ways in which that you don't necessarily have to follow your parents, the dictates of their view. But at the same time, he gave me such an incredible love and appreciation for music, for jazz, and understanding of who's here. Terms of, you know, racially, you know, the deities in our house were, like I say, Ella Fitzgerald. And I vaguely understood that he didn't have that fine enough appreciation for what I was doing. He'd come to my gig and at the end of the gig, he'd say, don't lose that drummer. You know, about all he could say. And he's right. I mean, like he'd say, you know, he really dug Russ Conkle's drumming. But I had him come over and I wanted to sit him down and play him The Pretender. And there's a song for him in the second half. And he was asleep before we got to the second half, you know? And I just went, well, that's just about perfect, you know?
He didn't hear Daddy's tune?
No, he didn't.
Wow. When he talked about like cutting your hair, and were those his resentments that he had to?
He wasn't resentful about it. He just thought that we were, you know, young and sowing our wild oats, but that there was, he was describing what he had done, which was he said he never thought he was a professional musician. He always thought of himself as an amateur, and that he had never really followed through or that he'd, you know, gotten the job, the jobs that he needed to do to have a family. And but he also told me really wild stuff, like he enjoyed being in the army because he didn't have to think. And to be 14 and to hear that, it was like, all I needed to know, that's okay, that kind of, kind of disqualifies you as a as an advisor, you know. But he also he'd say the coolest stuff. Like one time he said, he was over at my house and he was leaving. He said, well, play good. But you didn't have to say, he was an English teacher and a meticulous, he would correct us every night at the dinner table. We didn't have to learn grammar or any of the rules of grammar because we were just forced to speak correctly all the time. Not forced, but just admonished if we didn't. And I said to him, play good? What do you mean? Don't you mean play well? He said, yeah, but I've never heard a musician say play well.
Oh, nice.
Play good.
So how old were you then when you went to New York?
I was 18.
And you'd been playing around L.A. And then what took you to New York?
I'd been playing out in Orange County, you know, coffee houses and stuff. And I was living in Orange County. My friends were driving to New York. And there was like they needed a third person to share with the gas and share with the driving. We made that trip in 3 1/4 days. You know, it was like just straight through driving around the clock. We were delivering a car to my friend's family up in, I think it was up in Niagara Falls, that he had to deliver this Rambler American station wagon. And so we drove straight to New York and went to another friend's house who was living on the Lower East Side. So I had I was from a set of players and that hung around a club called the Paradox in Tustin. The reason they called it the Paradox was it was traditional music for contemporary minds, is what the guy's business card said. Yeah. In a way, it was the guy that owned the club sang a lot of Hank Williams. And he and his partner, their dream was to have a club where people came and made music. And in that club, I heard Sonny Cherry and Brian McGee, Jack Elliott. All these musicians that would come and play the Ash Grove in L.A. would always be looking for another gig. And there was a gig out in Orange County that they could go play a weekend, you know, and help defray the cost of coming west in the first place. So there was a really strong folk scene, and there were a bunch of songwriters. And these guys hired my friend, Steve Noonan, he got a gig there. It was really a big deal that one of us sort of rugrats were like, had a gig, like we could go hear each other's. And Steve sang some songs of mine and songs that he had written with Greg Copeland. And these are my mentors, you know, guys that were two years older than me, but let me hang with them. But when we went to New York, one of the things that happened in that first week or two that was there is that Tim Buckley had a gig at the Dom, and Nico was on the bill and she was being accompanied by Sterling Morrison. And apparently sometimes it would be Sterling, sometimes it would be Lou Reed, sometimes it would be John Cale, but she was leaving the Velvet Underground and to be a solo artist. And I think that it was the vibe, I don't really know this for sure, but the vibe was that it was all something that they were all agreed about. I think she stayed in the Velvets, might've been a more mainstream band, you know? On the other hand, I don't think they care that much about that, what's mainstream. They were actually like real outliers. Mm-hmm. But I think that they were helping her along with her transition to a solo artist. So she offered Tim Buckley the job of accompanying her, because I don't think maybe it didn't go well with her that one night it was one guy, one night it was another guy. So she wanted her own accompanist, and he called me and said that there was this child. He said, I don't think she understands that I have like a career that I'm like, she doesn't know about me. You know, like, I've got a gig in Boston next week. I'm not going to become her accompanist. And he knew I was destitute. I came to New York with $50 in my pocket and a Signal Oil credit card that I could use if it was an emergency. My mom's credit card, you know?
Yeah.
And without clothes for winter, it was the snow on the ground and I was wearing these loafers, you know, and like, I don't know what people thought about us. We're Californians, like wearing t-shirts and loafers and stuff in the snow. And like, what, you know, what are you doing? I had that job for just a little while. It didn't last very long. I wanted to go back home.
But you gave her some songs like These Days, which she made it.
Yeah. During that time, that song, her Chelsea Girl record was recorded and I was on a session. I mean, we recorded what we did. I mean, she'd learned three of my songs and they're on that record. And I also accompanied her on a Tim Harden song that where Tim Harden wrote a song about Lenny Bruce, a Dylan song called Keep It With Mine, which no one had ever heard before. It was like she was curating songs the way, really? I mean, I compare her to Judy Collins, because Judy Collins was the one who would make an album with something. She, before we coming to New York, I mean, the song I heard, a record I heard a lot, was her album in which she had Circle Game and an obscure Donovan song, a Leonard Cohen song, a Jacques Brel song. Mm-hmm. Judy Collins was really like curating songs and presenting them, you know, in, as a singer and as a stylist. And really, nobody thinks of her this way, of course, but that's what Nico was doing. She had collected a bunch of songs. She had Lou Reed songs, you know, Police, Kick and Stomp, Young Love, Pus Runs Through Matted Hair. I remember these songs. Mm-hmm. Lou Reed was he was on the session I was on. And that when I say on the session, it was just me and him. And she recorded the songs that in that day. And it was Tom Wilson, the great, great Columbia staff producer who had produced Bob Dylan. I don't know if he knew what to make of, you know, what to do as a producer, but what one thing they did was they took all these songs that were basically sung that she sang with one person playing guitar. Mm-hmm. And the day I was there, it was like the songs that I accompanied her on, the songs that she did with Lou Reed. Then later they put strings on everything, which Nico hated. She thought that was like, I think she thought it was kind of like an easy solution to like what to do with these songs. It was like a kind of one size fits all. It was a thing that just masked everything. But I think it resulted, like some of these songs like These Days and Fairest of the Seasons really benefited by having the strings. The string arrangements were great. Chelsea Girls had a kind of longevity and a kind of, there's a moment there that was sort of captured.
So why didn't you want to stay?
I guess I was just homesick, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I think about it, what would have happened if I stayed is an intriguing question for me, because I probably would have gotten in a band a little way sooner than I did. Mm-hmm. I would have been an East Coast musician. I would have been exposed to more kinds of music. But what I did, though, I mean, when I came back, I tried out for this band called The Gentle Soul. And then in that same audition, I met Jesse Ed Davis. And I also in that same sort of audition session was this guy, Leroy Marinell, who later co-wrote Werewolves of London with Warren Zevon and a couple other songs with him. So, I mean, I was growing, you know, I would go here, go there. On the way home from the airport, there was a leaked version of Sgt. Pepper playing on the radio. It wasn't supposed to be played.
Wow.
But somebody had this, I think B. Mitchell Reed, somebody had this copy of that he'd been given by one of the Beatles, and he just couldn't help himself. He played it on his show. People were going, ah, the Beatles are on KFWB. And a week later, the album came out. But I mean, there are all these momentous things for me to be hearing A Day in the Life and She's Leaving Home on the way home from an airport. But it was an exciting time for me. I was just, you know, writing songs, trying to write songs. I had started the song A Child in These Hills when I was in New York, because it was out of homesickness. It's like, you know, it's about being from a more pastoral place, you know.
We'll be right back with more from Jackson Brown. We're back with the rest of Bruce Headlam's interview with Jackson Brown.
It's interesting to think about what kind of songwriter you would have been had you stayed there.
Right.
Different influences, different.
Well, you know what? I mean, out in Orange County, where my friends and I were, you know, like, we're practically lived like squatters. I mean, somebody would rent a house and then there'd be like 20 people in it, you know. But they were really into the Velvet Underground, much more than I was when I was in New York. They got into the Velvet Underground and played that stuff all the time. So I never really like got the whole L.A., New York, the differences. Differences are more apparent to me now, but at the time, I didn't think that you were, you know. And everybody I met in New York wanted to come to California. I, you know, they find out that I was from LA and they say, okay, I want to go to LA. Let's go. I got a car. You want to go? I'd be looking at this girl with a Mustang and thinking, yeah, I want to go to LA. But, you know, it was an exciting time. Hey, I was 18 and there was a lot of world unfolding wherever I went.
I'm interested. If you could go back and talk to your 18-year-old self about writing.
I'd say what Dwayne Allman eventually did say to me. Mm-hmm. Like, this folk music thing, that's okay. And you do it really well, that's okay. But you need to be in a band, brother. Yeah. You need to play these songs with a drummer. Come on, man.
You're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but you have the single best induction speech.
I do. Even if it did really eclipse me right in there. I mean, everything about me was eclipsed by that speech. Oh, man.
No, not at all. Not at all. Now, everybody remembers the first part of that speech, and it's Bruce Springsteen describing how when he would play with you, you would get all the great-looking girls looking at you on stage, and the E Street Band would only get men. Yeah. And as he said, not very good-looking men. But that's the part people remember. But I think the heart of the speech, do you mind if I just play you a little clip of the heart of the speech? Is that okay?
Sure.
Jackson Browne gave us Paradise Lost. Now, I always imagine, what if Brian Wilson, long after he'd taken a bite of that orange that the serpent offered to him, what if he married that nice girl and Caroline No? I always figured that she was pregnant anyway. And what if he moved into the valley and had two sons? One of them would have looked and sounded just like Jackson Browne. Cain, of course, would have been Jackson's brother-in-arms, Warren Zevon. We love you, Warren. But Jackson to me was always the tempered voice of Abel, toiling in the vineyards, here to bear the earthly burdens, confronting the impossibility of love, here to do his father's work. Jackson's work was really California pop gospel. Listen to the chord changes of Rock Me on the Water, or Before the Deluge, it's gospel through and through.
Okay, other than he tried to upstage you on your night. I do think it's one of the great speeches I've ever heard about anything. I'm interested in your reaction to that.
Well, I was blown away. It was also so funny. But I was, you know, my reaction, you know, didn't escape my notice that there was a camera on me watching him say this stuff, you know, but it was huge, you know. See, for the longest time, I didn't know how to describe what I did. I didn't know that anybody, how many people really got what I did or how to describe it or what to say. The idea that someone else was going to stand there and sum it up or say in so many words what it is that I do was really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the word genius doesn't mean like that you're smarter than everybody. It means that there's one particular thing that is your genius. You know, one time I told a girlfriend of mine this. She said, oh, don't worry, you're not one. but the thing is that whatever it is that you're particularly good at, to have somebody describe that as an incredible gift, and that it's somebody that I think so much of that and has meant so much to me, that it was just a really overwhelming thing to have happen. At the same time, it was done with such love and such an embrace. It was, you know, incredible.
I find that a little scary, that speech. Almost not scary, but it puts a huge burden on you. To me, like, you're the responsible one. You're the guy who is like, who, you know, witnessing the failure of love, you know, the impossibility of love and trying to put together the fragments of our life. Yeah. And I thought, oh man, poor Jackson Browne. Like, but you almost, I'd read recently that you said you were writing songs when you were a kid, but you probably would have had more fun had you just gone out in a garage band and played Gloria for 3 hours, the way every other kid was doing.
Yeah, I still want to do that. As a matter of fact, I have some offers after wherever that was printed or said, like people say, like, hey, we want to play Gloria with you. That's true. There's something about that. Look, that's just a component that that got left out being on band in high school. But I didn't admire it. I liked Gloria, but I didn't really admire it was really hard place for songs to grow and for lyrics to be heard. Very hard. So I gravitated to the listening rooms where people really, really listened and thought about what they were listening to. And so, yeah, the thing is that there's joy. Rock and roll is so full of joy, and it's so full of the desire for freedom and the willingness to risk everything for it. You know, there is meaning in the sound of a ride cymbal. There's a way in which somebody does a particular rhythmical thing, or like a guitar chord, or way in which play, that is really more power, and there's more meaning in it than in the meaning of the words. Well, there's as much. So It's a bit, which you, I want both of those. I want this. I want, that's also like what I was trying to do in Downhill from Everywhere. I want you to listen to the way these guys are playing this. And we really worked on, that's my garage band there. You know, the thing that I've strived for was just to have the words engage you in a place where you care.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to do. And to do that, you have to hear them.
I'll just ask you one more question about that. Because we've determined that you've got a new album that's hard rocking and you're back in the game. All the nice things I want to say about your record. When you write, you do write political songs. Do you start out in anger sometimes?
Yeah, I met this guy once. He's a punk rocker. I can't remember his name now. And he was telling me, you know, I like your music. Okay. You know, I think it should be a little angrier. You know, I think you should be angrier. I just dug that he was willing to talk to me because it was such disdain with which all this nasal shoegazing, like introspective songwriters were sort of swept aside by punk music. But yeah, I think that after all, there's plenty of stuff that I'm angry about. I think that I have something similar, but it's not about getting the anger out, but the hope in. I want to engage about what's going on in this life and also try to at least chart a course or in some way, you know, direct myself and whoever else is listening to a possibility that things could be improved upon, you know. And really, that always comes down to improving yourself and first, you know.
Are you more hopeful now than you've been in the past?
Well, the Haitians say, you know, l'espoir fait vivre. Hope makes life. That's such a simple language, Haitian Creole, but I mean, what they mean is like hope makes life possible. So yeah, I'm hopeful as a motherfucker. You know, I'm trying to find it wherever I look, you know.
Okay, I think we've got your next album title.
Right. Hopeful as a motherfucker.
Well, listen, thank you so much for this. It's been just fantastic.
Bruce, thanks a lot for the conversation. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thanks to Jackson Brown for talking about his career and the inspiration behind his new album, Downhill from Everywhere. You can check out that album, plus all of our favorite Jackson Brown songs at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes.
You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafin. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.